Welcome to this week's podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. Joining me this week is Gareth Cavanagh. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Unit HQ, one of our quiet cuppa catch-ups.
Indeed.
Pertwee and no, he's not Pertwee really, is he? He's more like a sort of impish little Troughton, is James. While him and Tennant are off flying around the universe.
Well, actually, what they're doing, they're recording some commentaries for future podcasts.
Oh. Anything interesting?
I understand Delta and the Bannerman is one of them.
Not a bad choice.
So that should be interesting. So that's coming up for you, dear listener. Gareth and I are going to be chatting about a couple of Doctor Who and tangentially related things. And we're going to be finding out what Gareth's got going on in Manchester in forthcoming weeks and months. But before we get onto that, Doctor Who comics. James and I were talking about Doctor Who comics and Titan in particular last week, because I've been reviewing the Fourth Doctor series for the Doctor Who Companion, which is a rather good website. I don't know if you've seen it, Gareth.
I have. Yes, it seems to be run by quite nice chaps and doesn't seem to be a proxy for online gambling. So
indeed,
it's good by me.
Yeah. So the Titan Doctor Who books, I know you haven't read an awful lot of them, but at the same time, neither have I. So we're both kind of, right. I've only read the Fourth Doctor series, and I know you've seen the Absalom Dark.
I've read the Absalom Dark ones because I kind of feel I should, because we're still continuing to cover Absalom Dark hugely in Warp 3, and then I think we're out of Absalom Darkiness. So if they kill him, that would be quite useful, actually, because then we'd be complete. I feel like light, you know, I want to catalogue this thing, and you know, it keeps changing, and it's really irritating. So if Titan can kill him, ideally in the next 2 months, that would be great.
So what's going on with Absalom Dark then? How's he been revived?
Do you know, I can't remember how they revived him. I think they just found him, and he's out there travelling with the 11th Doctor.
Right.
And he's basically one of the two companions, the other companion being someone who I can't remember anything about. Isn't that terrible? And it's a sort of post-Time War narrative going on there, which I suppose is fair, because if you were in a Time War against the Daleks, you would want Absalom Dark as the ultimate warrior on board. But they've given him, to be fair, a little bit more light and shade. So he isn't just Conan with a chainsaw. He's got a little bit more in the tank. I've quite enjoyed them, actually.
Okay. So is there an implication that Dark was involved in the Time War?
That's what I'm reading it as.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think fits. I mean, the lovely thing about the Time War is no one ever really seems to say anything definitive. And the minute you say anything definitive, it tends to get ignored. So you might as well keep it. I think Russell kept it very oblique, and I think that worked. Strangely enough, I think the current production team have tried to be a bit more explicit, and yet they're the bits that haven't stuck in my memory. Isn't that weird?
Mm.
Yes. But yes, it's enjoyable to see. I mean, Absalom Dark is an interesting but difficult character, because the problem is that he is a nasty piece of work. He is, you know, he's a murderer, he's a smuggler, he's you know, he's on death row. He drags his dead girlfriend around with him. He's not your archetypal Doctor Who companion. And the problem I've always had with putting him with the Doctor is that you always end up with this sort of narrative, which we've kind of got, but not quite, with Dark going, oh, I'm going to kill that. No, Dark, don't kill it. You're better than that. Oh, right. Yes, you're right, Doctor. Then the plot goes on, and then the Doctor goes, actually, Dark, it'd be quite useful if you did kill all those things there. I promise I won't look. There should have been another way, blah, blah. And that's the problem with it. It's almost why Absalom Dark really needs to be spun off on his own, which is where he started. But so far, they seem to be making it work. But eventually, I expect him to start killing things that the doctors originally said, no, you shouldn't kill them. Actually, I think that'd be quite good if you killed them.
Is he... Is he recognisably absent in the Virgin novels? Was it Deceit?
That's a very strange novel, that.
Yeah.
It's because it's really more about... I mean, the answer is no, I don't think he is. This is something we looked at with a lot of the writers for the later years, and Steve Moore's view as to why the writers that came after him didn't get it right is that he says Absendark is actually all about Princess Tyen, the girl in the box. He said if you take her out of it, he's just a nutter with a chainsaw.
Mm.
So it needs that sort of tragic love affair where he's continually trying to revive her to bring something out of him. That was his theory, and I think it's probably not without merit. In that book, Deceit, if I remember rightly, and I haven't read it now for about, 23 years.
Yeah, same
here. I was young and slender back then. It's more about Ace, really, and I think, if I remember rightly, it's like a sort of alien marine team that lands somewhere.
Yeah.
And Absendark is one of the team, and I think they bring him out of cryostasis or something. And he's basically just a berserker. I don't think there's anything particularly memorable about him. He could have been called, Fred Killbot, and he would have done exactly the same job. So it's interesting. There is an argument that no one's got him right since Steve Moore, and then there's other people who say, well, Steve Moore lost his way with him. So I don't know. Difficult character.
Okay, well, that's you're talking there about the 11th Doctor Year 2, which I think it kicks off in issue 11. It's by Cy Spurrier and Rob Williams.
Well worth your time. Well worth your time.
Okay.
What was the 4th Doctor one like?
The 4th Doctor one's quite good. It's very Hinchcliffean. It is unfortunately littered with far too many in-jokes, which is basically my problem with meta-references and in-jokes kind of took over last week's podcast, because it takes you out of the story. And,
Give us an example.
There was a couple... there's a reference to Harry, which is completely pointless, and there's another one where the fourth Doctor is being slightly irritating to the villain, and she calls enough of this tomfoolery.
Oh.
Yes.
But does it look nice?
It looks beautiful. I've had a bit of a problem with some of the illustrations in some of the other ones, so I was a bit doubtful coming to this one. But the fourth Doctor one is very gothic. It's very dark. It's nicely illustrated.
Nice. And who's travelling with him? Is it Sarah?
It's Sarah, yes.
Okay. That sounds all right, actually.
Yeah, I would check it out. I would. I haven't looked at the other ones in the second year. I've got a few of the compilation comics that come out in the UK here, which package the...
There's so much 10,
11, 12 together, yeah. And, that's where you get this striking difference in illustration styles, and some of it, I feel, doesn't really suit Doctor Who. I know what art is subjective and everything, but, we get Doctor Who adventures for my little lad Bruce in this house, and the illustration in there is superior in many cases to what you're getting in Titan, which is supposed to be for, quote, grown-up, unquote, Doctor Who fans, so...
It's very difficult. I think that actually, in many ways, the Doctor Who... Well, firstly, I suppose the Titan comics have been made for the American markets. They're different.
Yeah.
Over here, the British Doctor Who comic fan base, which is mostly the DWM guys, does tend to be fairly conservative in the art it likes, must be said. Some of the crazier stuff... doesn't always fly, doesn't always translate. But to be fair to the guys at DWM, they always give someone newer go, and that keeps it fresh. So there are some odd artists out there, though. I must admit, I really wanted to love Big Trouble in Little China, those recent comics, but the art completely turned me off. And I don't mind something experimental, but this went beyond for me. It was almost that was the line where it's like, actually, now you've taken me out of it.
Yeah, I think you're right about that conservatism, but at the same time, there's a kind of you know, there's a need to have people look as they're supposed to look, isn't there? And that, I mean, that's an easy sort of segue to that old chestnut of people not looking how they look and particular actors getting a bit miffed about it.
Well, yes. Well, that has happened over the years, of course.
Yeah.
Davison, famously difficult to capture. But it is, that's how comics were at the time. I had a lovely chat with John Stokes, part of Warp Warp 3. He's one of the guys who worked on the Alan Moore strips, and it's to accompany the Alan Moore interview, big interview that we've got with Alan Moore in 3. Mm-hmm. And he said, I know we were talking about some of the strips and some of the likenesses and some of the things that he had to steal. We were talking about Star Wars in particular, because he did two of Alan's Star Wars strips, or was it three? Might have been three. Three completely bonkers Alan Moore Star Wars strips from Empire Strikes Back. And whereas with the backup strips in Doctor Who, he could pretty much do what he wanted, although he had to get a Sea Devil right and things like that. He said it was an absolute nightmare. He said, because this is pre-internet, he said, and I have to get Darth Vader right. I have to get a Stormtrooper right. I have to get Princess Leia kind of right. Mm. He said, or it isn't going to work because it's a tie-in. And he said, and there was no stuff. There was no internet. So he had to keep scrapbooks. He said he bought the Radio Times every week, TV Times, and he would pray that there'd be a picture of like Mr. Spock or Darth Vader or something. And he'd literally have to do it. And it's something that Dave Gibbons said he did as well with likenesses. He said all you could do, because you had so little references, you'd have to do one really good frame, like a sort of quarter page, which clearly was him, and then you'd have to move him out. So if you look at the Tides of Time, for instance, the first page, you'll see that there's a Davison splash, and you can almost pick the picture it's come from. And then in every other panel, he's got him in the background or somewhere in the mid distance because he isn't confident enough to draw him.
Right.
I don't know why Davison is so hard to draw. I suppose artists out there would tell us, but it's that pleasant open face.
Yes, it's got to be.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll move on. Toby Jones in Sherlock.
Now there's a man with a great face.
The Dream Lord. Yeah, indeed, Toby Jones has got a great face. Yeah. And he's popping up in a lot of stuff lately, isn't he? He's he's one of those great character actors. He was fantastic in that three-part series set in London where strange things were happening along the street. Someone was painting stuff up and down the street. It had Gemma Jones in well.
Yes, yeah, it was he was the city trader, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So
God, our memory is terrible.
it's strange tea we're drinking, it must be.
It is.
Yeah, it might get you started in the morning, but ginger and lemon tea, which is what I've got, is absolutely useful for the memory.
I'm on Earl Grey, old chap.
Earl Grey.
It is nearly 11 o'clock.
Absolutely. He says, I'm excited and intrigued by the character I shall be playing in Sherlock. Stephen Moffat says, delighted to have Toby Jones on board, bringing life to one of Doyle's finest villains. Gator says, we're thrilled to welcome one of our finest actors to the Sherlock family. I know Toby will embrace the part with relish. But who could he be playing? Is it Adalbert Gruner?
Now, I'm going to have to hold my hands up and say, beyond Moriarty, I can't think of any villains.
Yeah, I'm pretty much with you on that, to be honest with you. It's good to see Toby Jones is involved. And obviously, there's
a class act.
He is a class act. But,
you know, if we were in a less telegenic age, he would make a smashing doctor.
I think you're probably right. Although you could be argued that he has played the Doctor, depending on what your interpretation of the Dream Lord is.
What do we think the Dream Lord is?
I think he's a sort of proto-Valiard, but other than that, I don't know, really.
A sort of dark side of the Doctor?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea. It could be a dark projection of the Doctor. It could be something to do with those slightly trippy mushroom things that turn up in the TARDIS. He is good, though. Actually, he's a really underrated villain. He's one, and I like the way they leave it quite unexplained. It shows a confidence in the storytelling, though, where you just go, well, yeah, it could be this. Just, you know.
Do you think... I mean, Amy's Choice doesn't get perhaps the reputation it perhaps deserves. Do you think there's a bit of flat direction in there, in places? That's
It's quite. I don't know, actually. It is strangely overlooked, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is. It's like a. I mean, I suppose in essence, it's a remake of The Edge of Destruction with trippiness turned up to 11.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it is strangely overlooked. In fact, a lot of things are overlooked in that season. I think it's because it's quite an unsatisfying season, storytelling-wise, because the silence is quite a confusing thing that I've never really understood. And it all feels a bit bitty. And that one, yeah, that one does get overlooked, actually. The Doctor's wife tends to scoop the plaudits, and I get a feeling that the one with the Minotaur in it, the God Complex, is growing in stature. But yeah, that one's been forgotten. I don't know why. I don't recall any huge flatness in the direction, but I don't recall being knocked out by the direction either.
Mm.
Curious.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I'm confused about where it occurs now, because you've just been talking about the God Complex and the Doctor's Wife, and I'm thinking, are they the same series or not? And I can't, honestly can't remember. I thought,
I think they are.
I'm going to have to look this up now. Amy's Choice is the fifth series.
It's not, is it?
It is, yes.
Oh, God, it is. That's yes, right, because is, yeah. Adrian Salmon did a Weetabix card with the Dream Lord on it for season for Vought 2.
So,
oh, isn't that terrible? So, well, maybe the answer is because season 5 is pretty strong. It's the strongest of the Mafias by a country mile.
Yeah,
and it's got a nice completeness. And there's a great run of, it's just a great year and a great run of stories. That so perhaps it is just the fourth most brilliant thing in that year, whereas if it had been in the year after, which is a slim year, it probably would have stood out.
Perhaps you're right.
You know, in the same way, I suppose, something like Robots of Death. If Robots of Death happens a year later, it's a stone-cold classic, but because it's just one of another range of treasures that Hinchcliffe has assembled for our delights, it just kind of is like, oh, yeah, great, yeah, yeah. Robots of Death, brilliant.
Yeah,
next. Yeah.
So the reason we're talking about Toby Jones is because he's in Sherlock, and the big villain in Sherlock, obviously, is Andrew Scott's Moriarty. Now, it strikes me that there's a bit of a lack of big villains on TV these days. I mean, I can't think of anyone other than Andrew Scott who's got a name for playing a bad guy.
They've certainly died out in Doctor Who. We've lost that. That, yeah, I don't know where they've all gone. I know where they've all gone. They've all gone to Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is crammed with villainy of all quality. You know, you've got grand villainy. You've got evil for evil's sake villainy. You've got petty villainy. You've got out of your depth, slightly panicking, started off good, turned out evil villainy. Those are the sort of villainy. You know, we've got a whole host of villainy.
Who are you talking about with that last one?
Out of you, I'm thinking of people like King Tommen, then, who is, I think, is about to make a very silly mistake.
Yeah.
For the right reasons, but also the wrong reasons. That's who so it's that sort of almost sympathetic villain where circumstance or his own inadequacies have pushed him into doing something cruel that he'll never come back from.
Mm. I see. Wouldn't it be good to have Aidan Gillen in Doctor Who?
Oh, do you know, for years I was doing a one-man campaign to try and get him to be the Master.
Yeah.
Because I think he would have been stunning.
He's more absolutely or less the Master stunning now, though, isn't he, really?
He is. Yes, that's right, with his Knights of the Vale. Yes, he's horrid, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's like a sort of, he's like the Mandelson of Game of Thrones.
Oh, that's delicious. Excellent.
Yes. 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 So, you know, you've heard the Mandelson urban legend about guacamole, haven't you?
No, I haven't. Is it broadcastable?
It is.
All right, okay, got it.
It's one of those stories which for years everyone hoped was true. It wasn't, but it has a sort of, it has a German truth. Mandelson, for years, as you know, represented Hartlepool at the road. A good, solid northern you know, constituency in Manton is a very posh, urbane, educated man. And as the story went on a Friday night, you know, he did his man of the people act and went to his local fish and chip shop. And after he'd ordered his fish and chips, he said, "Oh, I will have some of your guacamole as well," pointing at mushy peas.
But this didn't happen.
No, sadly, it's not true. But what happened was the story, I mean, it's all over the internet and it has been for years. If you check it out, it's one of the great Mandelson memes. What happened was, is there was a researcher at the Labour Party told it as a joke in a party, and a journalist heard it and reported it. So, but as with everything, if it feels like the truth, it is the truth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So will you have to explain to your overseas listeners what mushy peas are?
Yeah, mushy peas are kind of peas mushed up. They're like... yeah, they're basically big marrow fat peas that have been soaked in water and then they're cooked in the water and they turn into a sort of semi sauce, which goes very well with...
bright green.
It's bright green, yeah. But it goes very well with cod and haddock, which are the usual fish caught off the North Sea coast, which is why we have them with chips and fish. Fish mostly. Or pies as well. Because the pie and pea thing's probably not doesn't translate beyond the UK either, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah, probably not. I don't think pies have travelled. No, I don't think so. Anyway, there you go. Mandelson and the guacamole. It's a treat.
If only it was...
So we haven't really had... Yeah, we don't have any villains now. In fact, Doctor Who is almost villainless now.
So is why the television, though, isn't it? You know, there was a day, like, there was a time 40, 50 years ago where you'd have guys who you knew were playing villains. That was what they did. Their role was to play the villain. The closest we've got to that now is probably Mark Strong.
I guess. There are some faces when they turn up and you think, oh, yeah, Baden. But mostly they are in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Soaps a little bit. Soaps still have their almost, you know, evil, delightful panther villains.
Who would you say?
Who's the evil scouse builder in Coronation Street at the moment?
Oh, right, I know who you mean, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, he's great. He's got a voice. He's got a face. It's like a face built for evil. He's like being custom designed for evil. So he's like that. You know, nasty Nick Cotton in EastEnders for years and years and years. Always a bad un. Always had the good face for it. Maybe we've just got a bit more sophisticated. I think maybe the trend now is that the beautiful, outside of Game of Thrones, it's the beautiful people that are the villains. And in fact, you know, even Game of Thrones has that, because the most evil people in it is Cersei Lannister, who is, you know, he's beautiful and majestic, but absolutely evil and rotten to the core.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a new trend that people like Toby Jones are more likely now to probably be playing, you know, that sort of the hardworking, decent chap who's being put down by the evil, beautiful people. Maybe that's the way it's gone.
Maybe it is. An interesting insight.
Maybe Galaxy 4 got it right. Maybe Galaxy 4 got it right all along with them evil Dravins and the lovely, hardworking reels.
Now, that is a turn I wasn't expecting. Okay, speaking of evil and villains, Michelle Gomez has been teasing that Missy may return. She says, asked whether she's spoken to anybody in the production crew about a possible return, she replied to the Radio Times, "Might have done, might not have done. I hope she will return. I mean, you just never know. They do keep the cards close to their chest." I do like this bit. On the BAFTA red carpet last weekend, she was quizzed about her favourite Missy moment. She says, "Do you know what? This is very naughty because I love Jenna Coleman so very much, but I did think Missy probably quite enjoyed pushing her down that hole. Michelle didn't enjoy pushing Jenna down that hole, but I think Missy did." Speaking in the third person there.
Delicious. Delicious. I think it's inevitable she'll be back, mostly because it's Stephen Moffat's final year, and I think I would imagine he has unfinished business with that character. Mostly because whoever comes in if they bring back the Master / Missy, or in whatever gender the Master returns, it'll be a fresh take on the Master, because it just will be, in the same way Missy is a fresh take on Russell's take on the Master, and so on. So I would say it's as close to dead cert as you can get that Millie will be back.
Do you think that it's going to be a sort of a greatest hits for Moffat in the last series?
Yeah, I think it's going to be type every and possible. There's lots of rumours that Captain Jack's back at Christmas.
Yeah.
That's another loose end to be... Although, well, yeah, I suppose technically Captain Jack is a Moffat loose end, because although Russell creates the character, he writes the first couple of scripts with Captain Jack in. So I suppose if he's going to come back and tie him off in Doctor Who, why not do it that way? Hopefully we've seen the end of River Song. I don't feel there's many more crevices in her timeline that we can extract more stuff. I have a horrible feeling I'll be wrong, but there we go. but yeah, I suspect it's going to be a tying up exercise, which then allows him to finish his era on his own terms and then leave the way clear for what will be probably close to a reboot, I would have thought, that will work for everyone. Because if you loved the Moffat era, then it's finished. It's a complete whole thing for you to enjoy.
Bookended.
If you hated the Moffat era, then it's all thrown in a Faraday cage and sealed for all eternity. It kind of works for everyone.
Unusual use of a Faraday cage there.
Yeah.
Okay. Gareth Cavanna.
Yeah.
I would like to say that you're some sort of ceaseless self-promoter or anything like that, but it's very unusual for us to have you on the podcast without you having something to tell us about.
Never turn up without product to plug. But yes, I do have some tantalising models. If you're in the Manchester area, July 2nd, we've got the wonderful Louise Jameson popping into Manchester's Fab Cafe for a morning, not a usual afternoon, a morning of with an in-depth conversation with our good friend Matt Charlton. So screenings, lots of chat about Who, but Matt's got a really interesting angle on this one. He wants to look at Louise's time through the prism of what was being said in the Radio Times, what was being, you know, through the prism of the popular media, and see how she was perceived.
Okay, that should be interesting. So this is a Saturday, is it?
This is Saturday morning. Doors open at 10 and it'll run until about 1 o'clock. It's because Louise is in the Mousetrap. She's touring all over the country in the Mousetrap, and she's in Manchester that week. So she very kindly found a couple of hours in her schedule to come and join us at Fab Cafe. So it's £8 in, which includes an autograph and a chance to see, I think, one of the great legends, certainly one of the great living legends of Doctor Who, at a time when Doctor Who was at its absolute zenith. One of the last Hinchcliffe era companion that's with us. A great woman as well. With us for the morning. So that's their special treat as ever. How I spoil you.
Absolutely, yeah, that should be really good.
Walk Through continues to rumble down the tracks, and we're aiming late summer with that. And we are will be working on the special free gift in a recording studio in Brighton at the end of this month.
Oh, are we allowed to ask what that is? Or rather, are you allowed to tell us what it is? Because obviously I can ask. Is it some sort of audio production?
It is some sort of audio production, yes. And it's going to have lots of lovely extras. But it's going to be available in two forms. It's going to be available in CD, which will be on two of the covers, because we're doing three covers for Vault Vault this time. Normally we do two. This time I really wanted one cover, and I wanted it so badly I said, look, I must have this cover, or I'm going to stamp my feet and walk out the door. So we got it. So the covers are, there's a TV 21 homage cover, which Colin's looking after, which has a brilliant hook, which I won't spoil, but it's ever so clever. And then there's two covers which homage the two greatest Alan Moore strips, backup strips, which of course we're looking at. So one cover, a big wraparound cover, which is Business as Usual, Auton's cover, which is being done by the amazing Martin Gatti. So he's doing cover A. Cover B is looks at Black Legacy and the Cybermen, and that's being done by our good friend, the wonderful Adrian Sun. Now, one of those covers is going to have the flexi disc, so there'll only be 500 flexi discs, and the others will have the CD. So the flexi disc is going to be the one to have. And if I see any of you swine selling it on eBay with a bite now of £50, I'll be coming round your house and putting a bat at night with it, because these are beautiful things. But I do hope people play them.
I saw Time Leech, the compiled Time Leech, on eBay for £50 once.
Oh, cheeky.
Yeah.
In a way, it's well, do you know, in a way, it is kind of a compliment because people make you look. On the other hand, I found yesterday, to my horror, I don't have a clean copy of Black Scrolls 8 anymore.
Oh,
so
really?
I'm gonna have to go on eBay and find one. That's going to be annoying. Yeah, all of mine seem to have. You know, I thought I was being awfully clever, and I've got like Barry Letts has signed it and things like that. So I've got these random people have signed it, thinking, oh, aren't I clever? And now I haven't got a bloody clean copy of it. So that's going on. Yeah, but the biggie,
yeah,
biggie is Starburst International Film Festival, which has just launched, which I'm festival director of, which is going to be 3 days of absolute treats in Manchester in a fantastic venue. Which is the purpose-built, brand-new, open, state-of-the-art student union building, Manchester Met Student Union Building. And we've got screenings, live commentaries, fringe events, personal appearances, all sorts of goodies, traders, and Doctor Who. And at the heart of it, on the Saturday, we're having a family day. So there'll be special family tickets from 10 till 4, which means everything in the building will be family friendly, and Doctor Who is going to have a very big presence at that. So we've got lots and lots of stuff ready to announce for that. But stuff we've got already to announce for that, we've got our lovely pal Bob Baker coming down to talk about Wallace and Gromit. We've got the great Caroline Munro and the Ray Harryhausen Foundation coming to talk about Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which of course
that was on last week. We were watching that last week.
Yeah, the great Tom Baker as the evil sorcerer, the part that got him the role of the Doctor, by all accounts. So we're showing that. We've got all sorts of lovely bloke. We've got John Glenn, who directed 6 Bond films.
On movies, yeah.
He's coming down, doing a big career retrospective and introducing his favourite Bond film, which is, interestingly, License to Kill.
Used to be my favourite for a long time.
Really? You see, I was holding out for Octopussy. I was really annoyed when he picked that. But, you know, I guess for the serious Bond connoisseur, then License to Kill must be close to perfection.
Well, it's not typical Bond. I think that's why.
No.
It's because it's Bond going off doing rogue stuff, which he does from time to time in the books, whether they're Fleming's books or Gardner's books. But, you know, in the other movies, he's always very steadfastly doing what he's told, but in his own way. Whereas in this one, he's not doing what he's told. He's going off on a vengeance mission, which makes it very,
and
very
it's
interesting.
Gritty and nasty, isn't it? And and visceral. I seem to remember the guy being blown up in the airlock chamber being pretty.
Oh yeah, weird. Milton Keys, I think he was called, or something like that.
Yeah. So it's an interesting one, but for me, you can't beat Bond in a mini submarine disguised as a crocodile. I'm afraid. But you know, John's obviously a man of all seasons. He can cover all that. We've got Peter Lamont coming, who is the Oscar-winning production designer of Titanic, but also was production designer on Aliens, on Superman, on a whole host of fantastic films. And most excitingly, for total niche but wonderful, we've got a guy called Peter Beale coming, who was head of 20th Century Fox London in the 70s.
Right.
And he was the guy who got Star Wars up and running. He was the guy who was sent, as he puts it, a collection of Ralph McQuarrie pictures, a script, and had to sit down with a young George Lucas and a young Gary Kurtz and just tell them how they were going to film it.
Wow.
He's amazing. He's got, and he's going to do a keynote lecture every day. He's doing one on making Star Wars, where he's going to take us through those McQuarrie artwork and just say, that's what I had. That's how I had to turn it into this. He's ace. He's doing one about the Force and how to find it, which is better physicality. Very interesting. And he's doing a masterclass about being a producer, because we're going to do a whole range of masterclasses through the weekend, including which one I think I'm going to need by Sunday, which is the lovely Virginia Hay from Farscape and Mad Max 2. Mm-hmm. He's doing what? Doing a meditation masterclass for an hour.
Okay.
Excellent. For that.
So when does this weekend take place?
26th to the 28th of August. Early bird tickets on sale now for a mere 60 of your Earth pounds. It's insult. But there'll also be a huge, great big knees up and party running all day and all night. And it also has, and I can't stress this strongly enough, a brilliant pub as part of the complex.
Wow.
Beautifully tiled with five real ale hand pulls. It's called The Salutation. Look it up. It is a beautiful pub, and we've got that for the whole weekend.
Superb.
So if you want to come along and do what some of us do at conventions and just chat to your friends and get trolleyed in the pub, we cater for that as well.
Excellent. Now, listen, we around this sort of time on a podcast, we possibly talk about recommendations and things like that. And before that we started recording, you were telling me that you'd seen Ant-Man recently.
Yeah.
And you enjoyed it?
I loved it. I thought Ant-Man was going to be terrible. I'd had a problem with Guardians of the Galaxy because I thought, oh, this is... There was no peril in it for me. It just felt like a video game that went on forever and full of characters I didn't care about. And I thought, Ant-Man? Really? Ant-Man? That's not even the C-list, you know? I've never even heard of Ant-Man. I thought, you're taking the P now. I'm not going to hand over my 8 Earth pounds to sit there and watch that and go, it's all right. So I ignored it. And having just sat through Batman versus Superman, which went on for about a million years and was about as much fun as having my teeth removed, aside from the excellent Jeremy Irons and Ben Affleck, who were very good, but everything else, I have to say, on the whole, felt like a really worthy lecture. I sat down with zero expectations for Ant-Man, and my God, it's good. It really is good. Great fun. I would recommend it highly. If you're a slightly miserable old fart who's a bit up yourself, a bit like I was last week, go and watch Ant-Man. It will revive the inner 8-year-old in you.
Well, having watched, just a quick aside, actually, before I continue, Henry Cavill, I spotted in an old episode of Midsommar Murders the other day.
Is that so?
Yes,
who
it
does
is.
He play? Does he play the hunky gardener who witnesses a murder?
No, he plays a sort of a hunky teenage or 20-something who is murdered.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, but you think the murderer is the great David Bradley, but it's not.
Oh, well, Dave Bradley's got one of those faces where you instantly go, it's him.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That reminds me, yeah, I mean, but some people have that. I remember when in my old pub, we had Barry Moll and a couple of people in for a drink after a Doctor Who convention across town. And I rounded up my regulars and I said, we've got the bloke who played Davros in the pub. And they went, really? I said, I'm going to line up on the wall, boy, and you've got to guess who Davros is. And there was Terry Molloy, there was another bloke, and then there was this third bloke, who some of you will know, who is a funeral director. He looks like the Hood out of
Thunderbirds. Yeah.
He's got this sort of bald head, big eyebrows. Nice, very nice chap, you know. And before anyone opened the mouth, they went, it's him, that's Davros, you know. And so I guess he just had the face to be Davros. And David Bradley sadly has one of them faces.
Yeah. Do you remember when Terry Molloy... Remember when Terry Molloy was on Harry Hill's TV Burp as Eric Clapton?
Oh, I don't remember that. He does look quite Clapton-y, though, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, it's on YouTube. But anyway, I was going to say, there's a thing, okay, with Ant-Man and with Civil War, which is the use of CGI to make key actors look 30 years younger.
Oh, yes, that's the opening, isn't it, with Robbie Downey?
Robert Downey Jr. in Civil War and with Michael Douglas in Ant-Man. Now I'm wondering if we've got Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which has got a star from the 80s in it, in Glenn Close, and we've got Thor 3 coming out this year with Hopkins. Which one of those two, or both perhaps, do you think is most likely to have CGI used to make them look 30 years younger?
Oh, it's gonna be Anthony Hopkins, really.
It's gonna be, hasn't it, really? Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins is cracking on a bit now, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. But how old is he? He's in his 70s. It must be hitting 80. He's definitely in his 70s. But I can see them doing.
Oh, but he's already been in it though, hasn't he? Didn't he play Thor's old man?
Yeah, he's Odin. But what I'm thinking is maybe there's something that Odin did that wasn't exactly a good idea. Looking 30 years younger, bit of a sort of a setup. For the Thor 3 film. I could be completely wrong. It might just be the same idea, but with Glenn Close in Guardians of the Galaxy 2. But I think they're now they can do this. I think it would be wise of them to do it where and where they can.
I thought the youthing of Robert Downey Jr. was amazing. It didn't feel as radical with Michael Douglas, funny enough, did it?
Yeah, no, I didn't, no.
But Robert Downey Jr., suddenly having him like he'd just stepped off a teen flick in the 80s. Yeah. It was like, wow, Jesus, I didn't see that coming. That was very clever. I watched Civil War yesterday.
What do you think of it?
Well, I think it's one of those films that in 30 years' time, that it'll be seen as a very political film. Because it's really all about that sort of post-Iraq, you know, we don't roll in and smash the place up and then bugger off for a cup of tea and leave everyone to pick up the pieces, that there are consequences. Although it does kind of have its cake and eat it with the ending anyway, without giving anything away.
Yeah.
I think it does. It's sort of, well, you know, yes, it's a yes, but no ending, isn't it?
Pretty much it is. Yeah. I mean, I think really the sort of nadir of the Marvel movies so far has been, Iron Man 3.
I remember quite enjoying that one, actually.
Oh, I think it got a little bit busy at the end. You didn't really know what was going on with all the suits flying around. And I did worry.
Oh, I suppose so, yeah.
And I had the same worries over Age of Ultron, to be honest with you.
I thought that was dreadful.
Yeah.
I thought that really was painting by numbers. I thought that was the worst.
Yeah, you're probably right. Guardians of the Galaxy.
But Guardians of the Galaxy at least had a great sense of humor and didn't take itself too seriously. Age of Ultron, it just all felt so inconsequential. And the fact that they chose to destroy some fictional country made it feel even more inconsequential. Oh, we've just killed bollocks of city, you know, it's bollocks, oh dear, you know. So I don't know. I don't follow these things closely enough to sort of, isn't that crazy? I suppose it's a bit like the last couple of years of Doctor Who. I've watched them all, but if I honestly had to describe the plot arc for the whole thing to you cold without the aid of an interwebular device, I don't think I could.
I'm thinking now whether I could or not, but I'm not so sure about that. But Civil War is certainly worth watching. But if you've got a choice between Civil War and Ant-Man, I'd watch Ant-Man first, not only because it's chronological.
No choice.
Yeah. It's a lot more fun as well.
Yeah.
Okay, then. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's podcast with a K. Big thank you, Gareth, for joining us this time.
Pleasure.
And look out for the Morning with Louise Jameson at the Fab Cafe on July the 4th?
July the 2nd.
July the 2nd. I beg your pardon, which is £8. And look
don't
out.
Don't go sending her there on Monday morning. That's just cruel.
July the 2nd.
Yeah, July the 2nd. Yeah.
And the Starburst weekend on the 26th and 28th of August. They both have Facebook pages, do they?
They both have Facebook pages. Louise will do by the time this goes out. Starburst got its own dedicated website at starburstfilmfest.co.uk.
Excellent. Until next.
And we'll have a brand new website once I get round to writing it. It's all built. I just haven't filled it with nice words, but it will come eventually.
Excellent. Until next time, it's goodbye.
Cheerio.